and would be so until his final days. For his first few years in Milan, before he was given space in the Corte Vecchia, he probably shared a studio with Ambrogio de Predis, one of Ludovico's favourite portrait painters, and his half-brothers Evangelista and Cristoforo, who was deaf and did not speak. Leonardo later wrote that observing how the deaf communicate was a good way to study the relation between human gestures and thoughts. Let your figures have actions appropriate to what they are intended to think or say, and these will be well learned by imitating the deaf, who by the motion of their hands, eyes, eyebrows, and the whole body, endeavour to express the sentiments of their mind. Soon after Leonardo began working with the De Predis brothers, they were jointly given a commission by the Confraternity of the Immaculate Conception, a worship group of rich laymen, to paint altar pieces for the Franciscan church that it used. To Leonardo fell the task of painting the central frame, and his instructions were explicit. It was to feature the Virgin Mary. Her skirt shall be of gold brocade over crimson in oil varnished with fine lacquer, and baby Jesus surrounded by angels done in oil to complete perfection with the two prophets. Ignoring these instructions, he decided to paint the Virgin Mary, the baby Jesus, a young John the Baptist, one angel, and no prophets. The scene he chose came from Apocrypha and medieval stories of the Holy Family meeting John on the road to Egypt as they fled Bethlehem after King Herod ordered the massacre of the innocents. Leonardo ended up producing two similar versions of the painting, which became known as the Virgin of the Rocks. Reams of scholarship have been produced debating the timing and backstories of these paintings. The most convincing narrative, I believe, is that the first version, done in the 1480s, led to a price dispute with the confraternity and was sold or sent elsewhere. It is now in the Louvre. See figure 64 in the PDF. Leonardo then helped to paint a replacement version in collaboration with Ambrogio de Predis and his studio, completed sometime around 1508. It is the one now in the National Gallery of London. See figure 65. The confraternity wanted a painting that would celebrate the Immaculate Conception, a doctrine pushed by the Franciscans asserting that the Virgin Mary was conceived free from all stain of original sin. Some of the iconography in the Virgin of the Rocks supports that idea, most notably the setting, a grotto of barren and dramatic rock formations that magically spawns flowering plants and four holy figures. We feel we are looking into the womb of the earth. The figures in front of the cave are bathed in warm light, but the shadowy inside is dark and intimidating. The locale harks back to Leonardo's recollection about coming across the mouth of a mysterious cave while hiking. The scene is not, however, an obvious evocation of the Immaculate Conception. Even though the Virgin Mary is the central figure, the narrative of the picture centres on John the Baptist, who was the patron saint of Florence and one of Leonardo's favourite subjects. The focus on John is especially true in the first Louvre version of the picture, where the angel is dramatically pointing to him, and that may have been one source of the friction between Leonardo and the confraternity. The first version, Louvre. Leonardo was a master at storytelling and conveying a sense of dramatic motion, and like many of his paintings, beginning with the Adoration of the Magi, the Virgin of the Rocks is a narrative. In his first version of the painting, the androgynous curly-haired angel begins the narrative by looking out directly from the scene, catching our eye, smiling enigmatically, and pointing to make us look at the baby Saint John. John, in turn, is dropping to his knees and clasping his hands in reverence toward the baby Jesus, who returns the gesture with a sign of blessing. The Madonna, her body twisted in motion, glances down at John and grasps his shoulder protectively while hovering her other hand over Jesus. And as our eyes finish a clockwise rotation of the scene, we notice the left hand of the angel holding Jesus as he leans on the rocky precipice over a pond, his hand touching the ledge. Taken in as a whole, it becomes a sequential medley of hand gestures presaging the Last Supper. The angel's pointing finger is the main feature that distinguishes the first version from the second. Thanks to modern technology, we know that Leonardo wrestled with the question of including this gesture. In 2009, technicians at the Louvre deployed an advanced set of infrared imaging techniques on the first version of the Virgin of the Rocks, which revealed an underdrawing that Leonardo used to compose the painting. It shows that when he began, he did not plan to have the angel pointing at John. That gesture was added only after most of the background rocks had been painted. Leonardo twice reversed himself, perhaps under pressure from his patrons. The pointing gesture is not in the original underdrawing, is in the first version of the painting, and is not in the second version. His hesitancy is understandable. The pointing gesture is awkward, and Leonardo seems to have sensed it when he did his second version. The angel's bony finger disrupts in a jarring way the connection between the Madonna's hovering hand and the head of her baby. The medley of hands becomes a cacophony of competing gestures. The narrative flow is rescued by the fluid areas of light, which give the painting a sense of unity. In this masterpiece, Leonardo ushered in a new era of art in which light and shade are juxtaposed in a manner that produces a powerful sense of flow. In Florence, Leonardo had edged away from using mainly tempera paints and had begun to rely more on oils, as had become the practice in the Netherlands, and in Milan he perfected his use of that medium. The ability to slowly apply thin layer upon layer of translucent color allowed him to create the shadings and gentle blurring of outlines that characterized his chiaroscuro and sfumato techniques. It also allowed him to produce luminous tones. The light would pass through the layers and reflect back from the primer coat, making it seem as if the light was emanating from the figures and objects themselves. Most artists, prior to Leonardo, differentiated the brightly lit areas of a painting from the shaded areas by adding more white pigment to their colors. But Leonardo knew that light doesn't merely brighten a color, it also reveals better its true and deep tones. Look at where the sunlight strikes the angel's red cloak and the Madonna's blue gown and golden drapery. The colors are saturated, and the tones richer. In his notes for a treatise on painting, Leonardo explained, "Since the quality of color is revealed by means of light, where there is more light, will be seen more of the true quality of the illuminated color." The first version of the Virgin of the Rocks is a vivid example of Leonardo's using his knowledge of science to inform his art. Its subject is both the Virgin and the rocks. As Anne Pizzorusso pointed out in her study, Leonardo's Geology, the components of the grotto are rendered with astounding geological accuracy. Most of the formations are of weathered sandstone, a sedimentary rock, but just above the Virgin's head and also at the top right of the picture are jutting hard-edged rock formations with facets that glimmer in the sun. These are diabase, an intrusive igneous rock formed by the cooling of volcanic lava. Even the vertical cracks caused by the cooling are rendered precisely. So is the seam between the sandstone and igneous formation running horizontally just above the Virgin's head. This is not merely a case of Leonardo's faithfully rendering a scene he saw in nature. The grotto is clearly a product of his imagination, not an actual place he visited. It took a deep appreciation of geology to conjure up a vision that was both so imaginative and so real. The plants in the picture are located, as they would be in nature, only in the sandstone regions that have weathered sufficiently to permit roots to take hold, both at the top and the floor of the grotto, but not in the hard igneous rocks. The species chosen are botanically and seasonally correct. He depicted only those that would be found in a moist grotto at the same time of year. Yet within these constraints, he was able to choose plants that conveyed his symbolic and artistic aims. As William Emberdon demonstrated in his study Leonardo da Vinci on Plants and Gardens, he introduced them into his paintings for their symbolic language, and yet he was careful to portray them in their proper setting. For example, A white rose is often used to symbolize the purity of Christ, but it would not have grown in such a grotto. So Leonardo instead paints underneath Christ's raised arm a primrose, Primula vulgaris, regarded as a sign of virtue because of its white flowers. Faintly discernible above the Virgin's left hand is a swirl of Gallium verum. The plant has long been known as Our Lady's bedstraw and is traditionally the plant of the manger, Emberdon wrote. Joseph used it to make Mary's bed, and its white leaves turned to gold when Jesus was born. Leonardo, who was obsessed with spirals and swirls, sometimes slightly altered plants to suit his artistic tastes. For example, at the lower left of the picture is a yellow flag iris, Iris pseudocorus, that is depicted with its sword-like leaves not lined up like a fan, but slightly contorted to show a spiral pattern, twisting to reflect the subtle turning motions of St. John and the Virgin. By the time this first version of the painting was finished in 1485, Leonardo and his partners had received payments totaling around 800 lira. But a prolonged dispute began when the painters insisted they had spent more than that on materials, especially the gold gilding, and that the work was worth far more. The confraternity balked, and the painting was probably never installed in their church. Instead, it was either sold to another client, perhaps the French king, Louis XII, or paid for by Ludovico Sforza as a wedding gift for his niece Bianca and the future Holy Roman Emperor Maximilian I. It eventually made its way into the Louvre. The second version, London. During the 1490s, Leonardo worked with Ambrogio de Predis on a new version of Virgin of the Rocks for the Confraternity of the Immaculate Conception to replace the one that had not been delivered. According to the technical studies reported in 2009, Leonardo began with a far different underdrawing. It featured a kneeling Virgin Mary in a posture of adoration with one hand across her breast. But then Leonardo changed his mind. He covered the new underdrawing with primer and drew another, one that very closely resembles the first version of Virgin of the Rocks, except that, as in the original underdrawing for the first version, the angel is not pointing at John the Baptist. In addition, the angel is not peering out from the picture at the viewer. Instead, his dreamy gaze seems to take in the whole scene. As a result, the narrative is not as distracting. The Virgin Mary becomes the unchallenged center of attention. Our eyes start on her serene face as she watches John kneel, and her hand hovers protectively over her child, this time not interrupted by the angel's intruding finger. The scene becomes one that features the gestures and emotions of the Virgin rather than the angel or John. Another subtle difference is that the grotto is more closed and there is less sky above. The light is therefore not as diffused, but instead comes in directionally as a beam from the left side of the painting, selectively falling upon and highlighting the four characters. As a result, the modelling, plasticity and three-dimensionality of the shapes are deeply enhanced. Between the first and second versions, Leonardo had been studying light and optics, and the result is an artistic use of light that was new in the history of art. In its dynamic qualities of variability and selectivity, in contrast to the static, even universal light of the Louvre version, it is the light of a new era, wrote the art historian John Shearman. The composition of this second version was clearly the work of Leonardo. The question arises, however, how much of the actual painting, which may have been done over the course of almost 15 years, was by him and how much was delegated to Ambrogio and the assistants at the studio. One indication that Leonardo delegated some of the work is that the plants are not as authentic as in the first version. It's very striking because they go against everything that Leonardo's always done in terms of his botanical art, according to horticulturalist John Grimshaw. They're not real flowers. They're odd concoctions, like a half-imagined aquilegia. The same divergences can be found in the geology. The rocks in the National Gallery painting are synthetic, stilted, grotesque characterizations, Pizzo Russo wrote, The rocks in the foreground are not finely bedded, but are roughly weathered and massive, giving the appearance of limestone rather than sandstone. The presence of limestone would be incongruous in this geological setting. Up until 2010, London's National Gallery had stated that its version was not primarily from Leonardo's hand. But after a thorough cleaning and restoration of the painting, the gallery's then-curator, Luke Sison, and other experts declared that it was in fact painted mainly by Leonardo. Sison conceded that there are lapses in the accuracy of some of the plants and rocks, but he claimed this reflects a more mature and metaphysical way of depicting nature that Leonardo began to pursue in the 1490s. This is no longer a picture just about devout naturalism. Leonardo combined those ingredients he regarded as essential, sometimes simply the most beautiful, to generate things, plants, landscapes, people, which were even more perfect, more completely themselves than nature had made. Especially when viewed after its recent cleaning, the London version does indeed display hallmarks that appear to be by Leonardo's hand. This is true of the angel, whose characteristic radiant curls seem distinctively his, and whose sheer sleeve caught by the sun rays is rendered with a remarkable translucence that comes from Leonardo's talent for applying thin layers of oil. No one who has looked at it closely can doubt who was responsible for the mouth and chin and the characteristic curves of the golden hair, Kenneth Clark wrote of the angel. It is also true of the Virgin's head, which, like that of the angel, suggests the use of Leonardo's characteristic finger blending of paint. All these effects lie definitively outside Ambrogio's range or that of any other known pupil, according to Martin Kemp. This second version of the painting, like the first, was caught up in contractual disputes with the confraternity, and the prolonged negotiation offers further evidence that Leonardo was personally involved in finishing the painting. It was still deemed incomplete by the time he left Milan in 1499, and in 1506 there was another tussle over whether a final payment was due. Leonardo ended up coming back to put finishing touches on the painting. Only then was it finally deemed complete, after which he and Ambrogio received their concluding payment from the confraternity. Teamwork. The questions about what contributions Leonardo's colleagues made to the second version of the rocks highlight the role that collaboration played in his studio. We tend to think of artists as lone creators, holed in a garret, waiting for inspiration to strike. But as evident in his notebooks and in the process that led to his drawing of Vitruvian Man, much of Leonardo's thinking was collegial. Ever since his salad days in the art production Bottega run by Verrocchio, Leonardo knew the joys and advantages of having a team. According to Larry Keith, who led the restoration of the National Gallery's Virgin of the Rocks, Leonardo's need to quickly create a studio capable of producing paintings, sculpture, courtly entertainments, and other activities meant that he worked closely with established Milanese painters as well as training his own apprentices. In order to make money, Leonardo at times helped his apprentices produce pieces as if on an assembly line, as had been the practice in Verrocchio's studio. Designs circulated between master and pupil using a kind of cut-and-paste technique involving master drawings and cartoons, Sison explained. Leonardo would create the compositions, cartoons, studies, and sketches. His students would copy them with pinpricks and work together on painting the finished version, often with Leonardo adding his own touches and making corrections. There were sometimes many variations, and different styles can be discerned in a single painting. One visitor to his studio described how two of Leonardo's pupils were doing some portraits, and he, from time to time, put a touch on them. Leonardo's apprentices and students did not merely copy his designs. A show at the Louvre in 2012 featured paintings that students and assistants in his workshop did of his masterpieces. Many were variations that were produced alongside his original, indicating that he and his colleagues were together exploring various alternative approaches to the planned painting. While Leonardo worked on the master version, other versions were being painted under his supervision. Head of a young woman. Depending on which religious stories you take as the text, The angel in Virgin of the Rocks is supposed to be either Gabriel or Uriel. He's identified on the Louvre website as Gabriel, but the description next to the painting in the museum itself calls him Uriel, proving there is no consensus even within that museum. Either way, Leonardo's drawing of him is so feminine that even some art critics have referred to him as a female. The angel, like the one he painted for Verrocchio's Baptism of Christ, is an example of Leonardo's proclivity for gender fluidity. Some 19th-century critics saw it as a mark of his homosexuality, especially since the positioning and outward gaze of the disturbingly alluring angel makes him seem a proxy for the artist. The androgynous nature of the figure is heightened by comparing the angel to what is generally regarded as a preparatory study for it, a drawing by Leonardo called Head of a Young Woman. See figure 66. The facial features of the young woman are virtually identical to those of Uriel Gabriel. The drawing is fascinating because it is one of the best displays of Leonardo's genius as a draftsman. With a few simple lines and brilliant strokes, concise and precise, he is able to create a sketch of unsurpassed beauty. At first glance, it captivates you. Then its deceptive simplicity draws you into a prolonged and profound engagement. The pioneering Renaissance art historian, Bernard Berenson, called it one of the finest achievements of all draftsmanship, and his protege, Kenneth Clark, proclaimed it one of the most beautiful, I dare say, in the world. Leonardo sometimes used ink or chalk for his drawings, but in this case he used a silver point stylus to incise lines on paper that he had coated with a pale pigment. The grooves are still visible. For highlights, such as the luster on her left cheekbone, he used a white gouache or watercolour. The drawing is an exquisite example of Leonardo's use of hatching to create shadows and texture. These parallel strokes are delicate and tight in some places, the shadow on her left cheek, and bold and spacious in others, her back shoulder. The variations in the hatching allow, with just simple strokes, wondrous gradations of shadow and subtle blurring of contours. Look at the nose and marvel at how the hatching models the left nostril. Then look how slightly wider lines make the contour and shadow of her left cheek. The two strong lines creasing her neck and the three strokes delineating the front of her neck seem hasty, but they also convey motion. The free-form curves to the left and right of her head look modernist, yet what they reveal is Leonardo's brainstorming process as it flows through his pen. As the abstract lines cascade down the back of her neck, they hint at the signature curls that he will paint. And then there are the eyes, which Leonardo made magically liquid. Her right eye has a rounded pupil with a full-on stare, but her left eyelid is heavy, pushing down over the pupil as if she's dreamily disengaged. Like the angel in the Louvre's Virgin of the Rocks, she stares out at us even as her left eye drifts. As you walk back and forth, her eyes follow you. She drinks you in. Chapter 16. The Milan Portraits. Portrait of a Musician. Among the many intriguing things about Leonardo are the mysteries that surround much of his work. Take, for example, Portrait of a Musician, painted in the mid-1480s, see figure 67 in the PDF. His only known portrait of a man, there are no surviving records or contemporary mentions of it. It is unclear who the subject is, and whether the work was commissioned or if it was ever delivered. It is not even certain that Leonardo painted all of it. And like far too many of his pieces, it is unfinished, though it is not known why. Painted on a walnut panel, which Leonardo had begun to favour, the portrait is of a young man with tightly coiled curls, no surprise there, seen in three-quarter profile, holding a folded sheet of music. His torso, brown vest and hands are unfinished. Even parts of his face seem missing some of the final layers Leonardo usually applied. And unlike Leonardo's other works, his body faces in the same direction as his gaze, with no sense of movement. The rigidity is one reason some have doubted that Leonardo painted it. But other elements, the curls, the expressive and liquid eyes, the use of light and shadow, have led most scholars to believe that he at least painted the face, and perhaps one of his students or assistants, such as Giovanni Antonio Boltraffio, added the unfinished and unimpressive torso. What most distinguishes the face as a Leonardo creation is the sense that this is an emotion-laden, real person with inner thoughts and a whiff of melancholy, whose motions of the mind are about to trigger a movement of the lips. There is no evidence that the painting was done as a paid commission, nor is it of a notable dignitary. It seems that Leonardo simply decided on his own to paint the young man. Perhaps Leonardo was moved by his delicate beauty and golden curls, or had a personal connection to him. Some have suggested the subject was Leonardo's friend, Franchino Gafurio, who had become the conductor of the cathedral choir in Milan in 1484, around the time the portrait was painted. But the portrait does not look like others known to be of Gafurio, who would have been in his mid-30s at the time, older than the man portrayed. I prefer to believe that the portrait is of Atalante Migliorotti, the young musician who accompanied Leonardo a few years earlier from Florence to Milan, bearing the lyre. He would go on to be a distinguished performer, but at the time he was in his early 20s and still working in the Sforza court along with Leonardo. If he was in fact the subject, it would make the musician a personal work that Leonardo undertook for his own satisfaction. We know that Leonardo was taken by Atalante's looks. In his inventory from 1482, there is that item, a portrait of Atalante with his face raised. Perhaps that was a study for this portrait, or even the beginnings of the painting itself. Although the musician does not have his face raised, he is gazing out into the light. Leonardo's treatment of the light on his face is the most striking feature of the painting. The spots of luster in the liquid eyeballs show how the light is falling. The illumination is stronger than in other paintings by Leonardo, who wrote that muted light is better for a portrait. But the strong light in this case allowed him to provide a brilliant demonstration of how light hits the contours of a face. The shadows beneath the cheekbone and chin, and even the right eyelid, make the portrait more lifelike than others of his era. In fact, one flaw in the painting is that the shadows are too harsh, especially under the nose. Leonardo would later warn about the crudeness produced by the use of sharp light. An object will display the greatest difference of light and shade when it is seen in the strongest light. But this should not be much used in painting, because the works would be crude and ungraceful. An object seen in a moderate light displays little difference in its light and shade, and this is the case towards evening or when the day is cloudy. Works painted then are tender, and every kind of face becomes graceful. Thus, in everything, extremes are to be avoided. Too much light gives crudeness. Too little prevents our seeing. The musician illustrates the effects of light and the perils of too much of it. Perhaps the flaw can be explained by the fact that the painting is not fully finished. Parts of the face do not have as many thin layers of oil as Leonardo usually used. If he had continued to perfect the painting, a process that often took him years, there likely would have been a few more strokes and a bit subtler texture, at least under the nose. There is one other notable feature about the light. The pupil of the eye dilates and contracts as it sees a less or greater light, Leonardo noted early on in his studies of the human eye and optics. He also observed how the changes in pupil size take a few moments as the eyes adjust to the light. Almost eerily, Leonardo has the two pupils of the musician dilated to different degrees. His left eye, which faces the light more directly, has a smaller pupil, which is correct. Again, Leonardo's science intersects with his art, this time to give us, in the subtlest of ways, a sense of the passing of a moment as our eyes sweep across the face of the musician from his left eye to his right. Cecilia Gallerani, The Lady with an Ermine. Cecilia Gallerani was a striking beauty who was born into Milan's educated middle class. Her father was a diplomat and financial agent for the Duke, and her mother was the daughter of a noted law professor. They were not exceedingly wealthy. Her father died when she was 7, and she had 6 brothers who divided up the inheritance. But they were cultured and educated. Cecilia composed poetry, delivered orations, wrote letters in Latin, and would later have 2 novels by Matteo Bandello dedicated to her. In 1483, when she was 10, her brothers were able to arrange a promising marriage contract for her to Giovanni Stefano Visconti, a member of the family that once ruled Milan. But 4 years later, before the wedding took place, the contract was dissolved. The brothers had not kept up with the dowry payments. The dissolution agreement noted that the marriage had not been consummated, protecting her virtue. There may have been another reason the contract was dissolved and the stipulation made about her virtue. Around that time, she attracted the notice of Ludovico Sforza. The de facto Duke of Milan was a ruthless man, but he had good taste. He was attracted to Cecilia for both her mind and her beauty. By 1489, when she was 15, she was living not with her family, but in rooms provided by Ludovico. The following year, she was pregnant with his son. There was one big problem with their relationship. Since 1480, Ludovico had been contracted to marry Beatrice d'Este, the daughter of Ercole d'Este, the Duke of Ferrara. The arrangement, which represented a major alliance for Ludovico with one of Italy's most ancient noble dynasties, had been made when Beatrice was 5, and their wedding was scheduled to take place when she turned 15 in 1490. It was to be an occasion marked by great pomp and pageantry. But Ludovico, enamoured with Cecilia, was unenthusiastic. In late 1490, the Duke of Ferrara's ambassador to Milan sent back a candid report. Ludovico was besotted with an innamorata, he told Beatrice's father. He keeps her with him at the castle and wherever he goes and wants to give her everything. She is pregnant and as beautiful as a flower, and often he brings me with him to visit her. As a result, the wedding between Ludovico and Beatrice was delayed. It finally took place the following year, with glorious celebrations in Pavia and then Milan. Over time, Ludovico would come to respect Beatrice and, as we will see, be deeply bereaved when she died. But initially, he continued his relationship with Cecilia, who stayed in a suite of rooms in the Sforza castle. In those days, before the pretense of sexual discretion was required of rulers, Ludovico continued to confide his feelings to the ever-informative Ferrara ambassador, who reported them back to Beatrice's father. Ludovico told the ambassador that he wished he could go and make love to Cecilia and be with her in peace, and this was what his wife wanted too, because she did not want to submit to him. Finally, after Cecilia gave birth to their son, who was fulsomely celebrated in sonnets by the court poets, Ludovico arranged for her to be married to a wealthy count, and she settled into the life of a respected literary patron. Cecilia Gallarani's alluring beauty would be captured for the ages. At the height of their relationship, around 1489, when she was 15, Ludovico commissioned Leonardo to paint her portrait. See figure 68. It was his first painting assignment for Leonardo, who had been in Milan for 7 years, had earned a role at court as an impresario, and had just begun work on the horse monument. The result is a stunning and innovative masterpiece, in many ways the most delightful and charming of Leonardo's paintings. Other than the Mona Lisa, it is my favourite of his works. Painted in oil on a walnut panel, the portrait of Cecilia, now known as Lady with an Ermine, was so innovative, so emotionally charged and alive, that it helped to transform the art of portraiture. The 20th century art historian John Pope Hennessy called it the first modern portrait and the first painting in European art to introduce the idea that a portrait may express the sitter's thoughts through posture and gestures. Instead of being shown in profile, as was traditional, she is in three-quarters view. Her body is turned to our left, but her head has seemingly snapped to our right to look at something, presumably Ludovico, coming from the direction of the light. The ermine she is holding also seems to have gone on alert, ears cocked, exceedingly alive, neither have the vacant or undirected stare found in other portraits of the time, including Leonardo's only previous portrait of a woman, Ginevra de' Benci. Something is happening in the scene. Leonardo has captured a narrative contained in an instant, one involving outward lives and inner lives. In the medley of hands, paws, eyes, and a mysterious smile, we see both motions of the body and motions of the mind. Leonardo loved puns, including visual ones, and just as the juniper plays on Ginevra de' Benci's name, so does the ermine, in Greek, gali, evoke the name of Galerani. A white ermine also was a symbol of purity. The ermine would die rather than soil itself, Leonardo wrote in one of his bestiary entries. And also, the ermine, out of moderation, never eats but once a day, and it would rather let itself be captured by hunters than take refuge in a dirty lair in order not to stain its purity. In addition, the ermine is a reference to Ludovico, who had been bestowed the Order of the Ermine by the King of Naples, prompting a court poet to lyricize him as the Italian Moor, the White Ermine. The twisting head and body, a form of contrapposto, had become one of Leonardo's lively signatures, such as in The Angel of Virgin of the Rocks. The writhing but poised ermine mimics Cecilia's movement, spiraling in sync with her. Both Cecilia's wrist and that of the ermine are gently cocked, protectively. Their shared vitality makes it seem that they are not merely characters in a picture, but players in a real-life situation, part of a scene involving a third participant, the off-scene Ludovico, who has caught their eye. At the time, Leonardo was formulating his theories of how the mind works. There is clearly a lot going on in Cecilia's. We see it not only in her eyes, but in her hint of a smile. Yet, as would be the case with the Mona Lisa, the smile is mysterious. Look at Cecilia 100 times and you will sense 100 different emotions. How happy is she to see Ludovico? Okay, now look again. The same is even true for her pet. Leonardo had such skill that he could make an ermine look intelligent. Leonardo took exquisite care with each detail, from the knuckles and tendons of Cecilia's hand to her braided and gauze-veiled hair. The coiffure and its sheathing, known as a coazzone, and her Spanish-style dress became fashionable in Milan in 1489, when Isabella of Aragon married the hapless Gian Galeazzo Sforza. The light on Cecilia is softer than that Leonardo used for the musician. The shadow under her nose is subtler. The greatest intensity of light, as Leonardo demonstrated in his optic studies, comes when a beam hits a surface head-on rather than at an oblique angle. This occurs on the top of Cecilia's left shoulder and right cheek. The illumination levels on the other contours of her face are done with delicate precision according to formulas he had developed for the proportional variations of light intensities at various angles of incidence. His scientific understanding of optics thus enhanced the three-dimensional illusion of the painting. Some of the shadows are softened by reflected or secondary radiance. For example, the lower edge of her right hand catches a glow from the ermine's white fur, and underneath her cheek, the shadow is softened by light reflected from her chest. When the arms cross in front of the breast, Leonardo wrote in his notebook, you should show, between the shadow cast by the arms on the breast and the shadow on the arms themselves, a little light seeming to fall through a space between the breast and the arms. And the more you wish the arm to look detached from the breast, the broader you must make the light. To truly appreciate Leonardo's genius, look at the spot in the painting where the ermine's furry head is set in front of the soft flesh of Cecilia's chest. The ermine's head is a marvel of modelling, rendered with three-dimensional clarity as the light strikes each strand of fur covering the subtly contoured skull. Cecilia's flesh is a soft blend of pale tones and reds, and its texture contrasts with that of the hard beads catching spots of lustrous light. The portrait was celebrated in a sonnet by the court poet Bernardo Bellincioni, with his usual orotund exuberance, in this case justified. Why are you angry? Whom do you envy, nature? Vinci, who has portrayed one of your stars? Cecilia, now so beautiful is she, whose lovely eyes cast the sun into dim shadow. He's made her seem to listen, but not to speak. Therefore you may now thank Ludovico and the genius and skill of Leonardo, who want her to belong to posterity. By noting that she seems to listen but not speak, Bellincioni conveyed what makes the portrait so momentous. It captures the sense of an inner mind at work. Her emotions seem to be revealed, or at least hinted at, by the look in her eyes, the enigma of her smile, and the erotic way she clutches and caresses the ermine. She is visibly thinking, and her face flickers with emotions. As Leonardo portrayed the motions of her mind and soul, he played with our own inner thoughts in a way that no portrait had done before. La Belle Ferronnière. Leonardo's experimentation with light and shadow is seen in another portrait from this period of a woman in the Sforza court known as La Belle Ferronnière. See figure 69. The subject is most likely Lucrezia Crivelli, who succeeded Cecilia as Ludovico's maîtresse en titre, official mistress, even though such duties would seem to conflict, or perhaps not, with her role as the lady-in-waiting to Ludovico's new wife, Beatrice d'Este. Like Cecilia, Lucrezia bore Ludovico a son, and apparently was similarly rewarded with a portrait of herself by Leonardo. Indeed, the walnut panel on which Leonardo painted it was likely from the same tree as the panel for Cecilia's portrait. Leonardo's depiction of reflected light is most evident under Lucrezia's left cheek. Her chin and neck are in gentle, muted shadows, but the light, which comes from the top left of the painting, falls directly on the smooth and flat plane of her shoulder, and then it bounces up and causes a streak of light, almost exaggerated and of a strange mottled hue, on her left jawbone. As Leonardo wrote in his notebook, reverberations are caused by bodies of bright nature with flat and semi-opaque surfaces. When struck by light, they rebound it back like the bounce of a ball. Leonardo was then deeply immersed in his scientific study of how light varies according to the angle at which it strikes a curved surface, and his notebooks are filled with carefully measured and annotated diagrams, see figures 71 and 72. No painter captured so perfectly how shadows and highlights on a face can make it appear three-dimensional and perfectly modelled. The problem is that the streak of light on Lucrezia's cheekbone is so glaring that it seems unnatural, causing some to speculate that it was later painted by an overeager pupil or restorer. That seems unlikely. I think it's more probable that Leonardo was so intent on showing light reflected into a shadow that he overdid it slightly, daring to be unsubtle. In this portrait, Leonardo also continued to experiment with his haunting method of creating a stare or gaze that seems to follow a viewer around a room. This Mona Lisa effect is not magical. It simply comes from drawing a realistic set of eyes, staring directly at the viewer with proper perspective, shading, and modeling. But Leonardo discovered that the effect works best when the gaze is intense and the eyes slightly off-kilter, thus making it more noticeable. He was refining the technique he had used in Ginevra di Benci. Ginevra's stare seems slightly averted and distant until you look at each eye individually and directly. Then you see that each, in its own way, is looking at you. Likewise, in La Belle Ferronnière, Lucrezia seems to be staring so directly that it can make us uncomfortable. When you look at each eye individually, it seems to be looking right at you, and this seems true even as you walk back and forth in front of the painting. But when you try to engage both of her eyes at the same time, they seem slightly unaligned. Her left eye appears to be looking off into the distance, perhaps drifting a bit to the left, partly because the eyeball is shifted. It is hard to meet her gaze in both eyes. La Belle Ferronnière is not in the same league as Lady with an Ermine or the Mona Lisa. There's a hint of a smile, but it's not truly alluring or mysterious. The reflected light on the left jawbone seems too studied. The hair is so flat and uninspired, especially compared to Leonardo's usual standards, that it seems to have been painted by others. The head is turned, but the body is rigid, rather than having even a hint of a Leonardo-esque twist. The headband and necklace display no mastery of modelling. In fact, they look somewhat unfinished. Only the ribbons on her shoulders flow and catch the light in a masterful way. The great Bernard Berenson wrote in 1907, "One would regret to have to accept this as Leonardo's own work," though Berenson ultimately did. His protégé, Kenneth Clarke, suggested that it was churned out to please the Duke but not captivate the ages. "I am now inclined to think that the picture is by Leonardo and shows how in these years he was willing to subdue his genius to the needs of the court." There is enough evidence, I think, to support an attribution, in whole or part, to Leonardo. The use of a walnut panel similar in grain to that of Lady with an Ermine, the existence of some court sonnets that seem to refer to his painting such a work, and the fact that some aspects of the painting have a beauty worthy of the master. Perhaps it was a collaborative work of his studio produced to fulfil a ducal commission, with some involvement from Leonardo's brush, but not his heart and soul. Portrait of a Young Fiancée, also known as La Bella Principessa. In early 1998, a profile of a young woman drawn with coloured chalk on vellum was put up for auction at Christie's in Manhattan. See figure 70. The artist and subject were unknown, and it was described in the catalogue as the work of one of the early 19th century Germans who imitated the style of the Italian Renaissance. A collector named Peter Silverman, who had an eye for spotting hidden treasures, saw it in a catalogue and was so intrigued that he went to inspect it at the showroom. "This is really good," he later recalled thinking. "I don't understand why it's catalogued as 19th century." He sensed that it had actually been made during the Renaissance. So he submitted a bid of $18,000, double the minimum estimate set by the auction house. It was not quite enough. His bid was topped by one of $21,850, and Silverman assumed that he would never see the portrait again. But 9 years later, Silverman happened into a gallery on Manhattan's Upper East Side owned by Kate Gans, a respected dealer who specialized in Italian old master drawings. On an easel in the middle of a table near the door sat the beguiling portrait. Once again he became convinced it was by a Renaissance master. "The young woman seemed alive and breathing, every feature perfect," he recalled. "Her mouth was serene, her lips gently parted with the subtlest hint of expression, but her eye in profile was radiant with emotion. The formality of the portrait could not mask her blushing youth. She was exquisite." Feigning nonchalance, he asked Gans the price. She offered to sell it for about what it had sold for 9 years earlier. Silverman's wife hastily arranged for a wire transfer of the money, and he walked out of the gallery with the picture wrapped in an envelope under his arm. As a work of art, the picture is alluring but not extraordinary. The subject is portrayed in conventional profile, body rigid with little of Leonardo's usual sense of coiled movements of the body and mind. Its primary artistic distinction is the subject's hint of a smile that changes slightly based on the viewer's angle and distance, thus prefiguring that of the Mona Lisa. What is most interesting about the portrait is Silverman's quest to prove that it was by Leonardo. Like most artists of his time, Leonardo never signed his works nor kept a record of them. So the question of authentication, figuring out which truly deserved to be called autograph works by Leonardo, becomes yet another fascinating aspect of grappling with his genius. In the case of the portrait that Silverman bought, the saga involved a combination of detective work, technical wizardry, historical research, and connoisseurship. The interdisciplinary effort which wove together art and science was worthy of Leonardo, who would have appreciated the interplay between those who love the humanities and those who love technology. The process began with connoisseurs, people with a deep intuition about works of art based on years of studied appreciation. Many of the attributions made during the 19th and 20th century were driven by the connoisseurship of art authorities such as Walter Pater, Bernard Berenson, Roger Fry, and Kenneth Clarke. But connoisseurship can be controversial. It was put on trial, for example, in a 1920s case involving the authenticity of another purported Leonardo work, a copy of La Belle Ferronnière, that had turned up in Kansas City. "This is not for beginners," Berenson explained as an expert witness. "It takes a very long time before you get a sort of sixth sense that comes from accumulated experience." He declared that the picture in question was not by Leonardo, prompting the owner to dismiss him as the major domo of picture guessers. After 15 hours, the jury declared it could not reach a verdict, and the case was later settled with a compromise. In this instance, the connoisseurs were right. The picture in question was not by Leonardo. But the case became a rallying point for populists who felt the world of art connoisseurs was an elitist cabal. The connoisseurs who initially saw the drawing that Silverman purchased, including the experts at Christie's and those consulted by the dealer Kate Gans, summarily dismissed the idea that it might be a true Renaissance work. But Silverman was convinced that it was. He brought it to Paris, where he had an apartment, and showed it to the art historian Mina Grigori. She told him, "This drawing shows dual influences, Florentine in its delicate beauty and Lombard in the costume and braid, or coazzone, which were typical of a court lady of the late 15th century. Of course, the most obvious artist to come to mind is Leonardo, one of the few artists who made the transition from Florentine to Milanese." She encouraged Silverman to investigate further. One day, Silverman was at the Louvre, admiring a portrait by Giovanni Antonio Boltraffio, who worked in Leonardo's studio. There he ran into Nicholas Turner, a former curator at the British Museum and the Getty in Los Angeles. Silverman pulled out his digital camera and showed him a photograph of the portrait. "I saw a transparency of this not long ago," Turner said, calling the work remarkable. At that point, Silverman still assumed the work was by one of Leonardo's pupils or disciples. Turner surprised him by disagreeing, pointing out the left-handed slanted hatchings that were Leonardo's hallmark. He said that it was likely by the master himself. "All aspects of the shading of this portrait provide visual testimony of Leonardo's theories of illumination," Turner later pronounced. The problem with relying on connoisseurs is that in any difficult case, there is usually an equal and opposite cadre of them. Among the most prominent naysayers were Thomas Hoving, director of New York's Metropolitan Museum, and Carmen Bambach, the curator of drawings there. Hoving, a charismatic showman, called the picture too sweet, and Bambach, a respected and diligent scholar, invoked her intuition to declare, "It does not look like a Leonardo." Bambach also pointed out that there was no known case of Leonardo drawing on vellum. That is true for the 4,000 known autographed drawings he made on his own, but the geometrical illustrations he made for two of the editions of Luca Pacioli's On Divine Proportion were on vellum. That would turn out to be a clue. It indicated that if the portrait of the young woman was by Leonardo, then it may have been done for a book produced by someone else. Gans, the art dealer, who had sold the picture to Silverman, not surprisingly agreed with the skeptical New York connoisseurs. "At the end of the day," she told the New York Times, "when you talk about connoisseurship, it comes down to whether something is beautiful enough to be a Leonardo, whether it resonates with all of the qualities that define his handwriting, sublime modelling, exquisite delicacy, an unparalleled understanding of anatomy. And to me, this drawing has none of those things." With connoisseurs divided, the next step was to set up a Leonardo-esque interplay between intuition and scientific experimentation. Silverman began by having the vellum dated by a carbon-24 test, which measures the decay of carbon in organic material to determine how old it is. The results indicated that the vellum came from sometime between 1440 and 1650. That proved little, since a forger or copier could have found a piece of old vellum, but at least it didn't eliminate Leonardo. Silverman then took the picture to Lumiere Technology, a Paris-based company that specializes in digital, infrared, and multispectral analysis of artworks. He rode there on the back of a friend's Vespa, clutching the portrait in his arms. Pascal Cotte, the firm's founder and chief technology officer, made a series of super high-resolution digital photographs that could capture 1,600 pixels per square millimeter. That enabled the image to be magnified hundreds of times, showing each strand of hair. The magnified images allowed a precise comparison of the picture's details with works known to be by Leonardo. The interlaced ornamentation of the young woman's costume, for example, had loops and knotwork that were twined in the same way as the ornamentation in Lady with an Ermine, and they were even done with the shadows meticulously drawn and the proper perspective as the ornamentation receded. As Vasari wrote of Leonardo, he even went so far as to waste his time in drawing knots of cords. Another example was the iris of the eye. The comparison to Lady with an Ermine, Silverman said, showed a thrillingly identical treatment of each detail, including the outer corner of the eyelid, the fold of the upper eyelid, the contour of the iris, the lower eyelashes, the upper eyelashes, and the juxtaposition of the edge of the lower eyelid with the bottom edge of the iris. Silverman and Kott showed the high-resolution studies to other experts. The first was Christina Gedo, a Leonardo scholar at the University of Geneva. She was struck by the use of three-color, black, white, red, pastel crayons, a technique that Leonardo pioneered and discussed in his notebooks. Close examination of the portrait's surface reveals it is extensively drawn with fine, left-handed shading, slanting from top left to bottom right, which may be seen both with the naked eye and, far more effectively, in the digital scans made under infrared light, she wrote in a scholarly journal. The dean of Leonardo scholars, Carlo Pedretti, also weighed in, writing, "The sitter's profile is sublime, and the eye is drawn exactly as it is in so many of Leonardo's drawings of this period. For example, the proportions of the head and neck, along with the details of the way the eyes are delineated, correspond very closely to a drawing from around 1490, now in the Royal Collection at Windsor, called Portrait of a Young Woman in Profile, and of a drawing he would do of Isabella d'Este in Mantua in 1500. At that point, Silverman and Kott turned to Martin Kemp, an Oxford don of impeccable integrity, whose career was focused on studying Leonardo. Kemp, who regularly received missives asking him to authenticate purported Leonardo works, was not optimistic when he opened, in March 2008, the email of a high resolution of the portrait from Lumiere Technology. Oh dear, another bout of painful correspondence, he thought. But as he magnified the image on his computer and carefully studied the left-handed hatching and details, he felt a shiver of excitement. "If you look at the hairband, it pulls this little dip in the back of her hair," he said. Leonardo always had that wonderful feeling for the stiffness of materials, for how they react under pressure. Kemp, who took no money or expenses for his expert opinions, agreed to travel to see the original, by then stored in a Zurich bank vault. He was cautious, but after studying the portrait for a few hours from every angle, he became more positive. "Her ear plays a subtle game of hide-and-seek below the gentle waves of her hair," he noticed. "The iris of her pensive eye retains the translucent radiance of a living, breathing person." Kemp became a believer. "After 40 years in the Leonardo business, I thought I'd seen it all," he told Silverman. "But I had not. The delight I had when I first saw it has been reinforced enormously. I'm absolutely convinced." He partnered with Kott to accumulate more evidence and publish it as a book, La Bella Principessa, The Story of the New Masterpiece by Leonardo da Vinci. The subject's dress and her coazzone hairstyle indicate that she was connected to Ludovico Sforza's court in Milan in the 1490s. Leonardo had already painted two of Ludovico's mistresses, Cecilia Galerani in Lady with an Ermine and Lucrezia Crivelli in La Belle Ferroniere. Who might this third woman be? Through a process of elimination, Kemp identified her as Bianca Sforza, the Duke's illegitimate but later legitimated daughter. In 1496, when she was about 13, she was married to one of the most important members of the court, Galeazzo Sanseverino, the commander of Ludovico's military and a close friend of Leonardo, who spent time at his stables making drawings for his horse monument. A few months after she married, Bianca died of what may have been a problem pregnancy. Kemp decided to name the portrait La Bella Principessa, even though the Duke's daughters weren't officially princesses. There was one other key piece of scientific evidence that sealed the authentication, or at least initially seemed to do so. Cott had uncovered in his scans a fingerprint on the top of the portrait. If it could be matched to a fingerprint on another work by Leonardo, who often used his hands and fingers to smooth his colours, that would come close to being dispositive. Cott gave an image of the fingerprint to Christophe Champod, a professor at the Institute of Criminology and Criminal Law in Lausanne. Finding it almost impossible to read, he crowdsourced the task, posting it on a website and getting close to 50 people offering their annotations. Alas, the result was inconclusive. No patterns could be determined. "I consider this mark as being of no value," Champod declared. At this point, a controversial character entered the tale, Peter Paul Bureau, a forensic art examiner based in Montreal, specialized in finding and using fingerprints to authenticate art. He had done so, or claimed to have, with artists ranging from J.M.W. Turner to Jackson Pollock, shaking up the insular club of art connoisseurs in the process. Kemp, Cott and Silverman contacted him in early 2009 to render his verdict on La Bella Principessa. Using a digital enlargement of the picture, Bureau claimed that he was able to discern ridgepath details of the fingerprint, and he compared it to a fingerprint that Leonardo was known to have left on St. Jerome in the wilderness. He declared that there were at least 8 points of similarity, and he also claimed that these were compatible with a fingerprint on Leonardo's Ginevra de Benci. Bureau demonstrated his discoveries to David Gran, a respected best-selling author and staff writer at The New Yorker, who was writing a profile of him. Bureau zoomed in on the blurry lines and then showed a series of images taken by multispectral cameras. That still did not make the prints clear enough. He told Gran that he had then applied a proprietary technique, which he didn't demonstrate, to produce a clearer image. This new image allowed him, he said, to pinpoint the 8 points of similarity with the St. Jerome print. For a moment, Bureau stared at the prints in silence, as if still awed by what he had found, Gran reported. The discovery, he said, was a validation of his life's work. Bureau detailed his claims in a chapter he wrote for the book by Kemp and Cott, which was published in 2010. The correspondence between the fingerprints on Leonardo's St. Jerome and La Bella Principessa provides a highly valuable piece of evidence among the numerous other analyses presented in this book, Bureau concluded. Though he said that the evidence was not strong enough to decide a criminal legal case, the coincidence of the 8 marked characteristics is strongly supportive of Leonardo's authorship. The fingerprint evidence made headlines worldwide when it was released in October 2009. The art world is abuzz with the recent discovery that a portrait thought to be the drawing of an unknown 19th-century German artist is now being attributed to the Italian master Leonardo da Vinci, Time magazine reported. And the way the revelation was made is straight out of a Sherlock Holmes novel. Researchers traced the portrait to the artist using a 500-year-old fingerprint. The Guardian announced, "Art experts believe a new portrait by Leonardo da Vinci may have been discovered thanks to a 500-year-old fingerprint." And the BBC headline was, "Finger points to new Da Vinci art." Silverman gave the inside